Thank you. Hi, my name is Bob. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Bob. Hi, Bob.
When Karen first asked me to speak, I said I had just spoken here, and I thought, and she said, well, you're not on the list of having spoken, and I thought about it. Audley had asked me to speak at the 4:30 meeting about a month ago, and that's what it was, the same room, so that's why I thought it was this meeting, but it wasn't. But anyways, I'm grateful to be able to do this, and I've learned to not say no when asked to speak. I guess I'm supposed to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, what it's like today. I'm here obviously because I had problems with alcohol, and I was one of the lucky ones that got into this program when I was very young, and through the grace of God, I stayed here. To start from the beginning, I was brought up in a really loving household. I used to say, I hear a lot of people say I was brought up in a dysfunctional household. I wasn't. Then I started to change it and say I was, because I was in it. I created havoc in the family. I was different from everybody else. You know, my family would engage in family-oriented type activities and stuff, and I wanted no part of it. Even though I was sitting home watching TV at night and laughing at comedy shows or whatever, I found nothing funny about it. I couldn't sit there with them and laugh at these shows. It just wasn't funny. I mean, I didn't have a sense of humor. I just was different from the rest, and never gave it much thought. I went to a really strict private school, and I didn't like it, but I went there, and it was run by nuns, and we were put through a lot of, I don't want to get on that subject, but put through a lot of verbal, mental, and physical abuse, and beat my self-esteem right down to the ground, and thought I was going to hell because we were told that we were bad children, and we weren't, you know. We were bad kids, and we were going to hell, and I believed in a punishing God and things like that. And so anyways, I grew up with a lot of fears, doubts, and unfounded fears, doubts, and insecurities. I was adopted when I was like a year old, and my parents were my age now when I was an infant. And so as soon as I got old enough to recognize things, I realized that my parents were a lot older than, you know, my contemporaries' parents. And it's like, wow, what is this, you know? And then I had these fears of abandonment. What if they died? I remember once looking at my mother's driver's license, seeing her age, and it's like, oh my God, she's really up there in age. And other parents were like in their 20s, and mine was like in her 50s. And it's like, and I had these fears of like, you know, what am I going to do? What if they die or whatever? And just crazy fears like that. And I used to worry about tests in school, and I was a straight-A student, and I was doing very well, but I'd sit there up at night and keeping myself up at night and worrying about passing a test and things like that. And so it's craziness. And that was the change. When it came time to go to high school, they wanted me to go to a private high school, and I fought tooth and nail to not go there. I wanted to go where a lot of friends of mine were going, and just to a public high school, and they finally got my way, and I went. And it was totally different from what I was accustomed to. It was very lenient, for one thing, and but I didn't fit in. I had spoken a little earlier at the other meeting. It's going to be a little redundant, but I just didn't fit in with the students in my first year of high school, because we weren't exposed to school to partying and drinking and drugging, and not that they exposed you to that in school, but a lot of these kids were exposed to that, and we never had school dances or anything like that. So I started to engage in school activities and all, and I'd go there, and I couldn't do it. I mean, I couldn't dance. I didn't know how to dance. I tried. I didn't know how to move one foot over the next or whatever, and a lot of these kids were tanked up on alcohol and smoking pot and things. Hard drugs weren't a big thing back then. I guess it was out there, and I was afraid to try alcohol, and I was afraid to try smoking pot. A friend of mine who I'd gone to that private school with, his father was an alcoholic, and I saw the hell that he and his family went through, and I had nothing but compassion for him. The father would get drunk, and they'd have these parties in their basement, and it sounded like a lot of fun. Then all of a sudden, he'd be beating up the mother, and he'd be lying in bed for like a week or two, and my friend would make up excuses that he had some kind of a disease from the war, and he was just, you know, drunk, rum-dum, or whatever, sick from it, and he was just lying in bed like that. And so I didn't see any good in it, and I just figured I don't want to do this, but that was all the change. I was had an opportunity of a lifetime presented itself. A bunch of kids were skipping school, and they were going to the beach, which was like, you know, probably a half an hour ride from where I lived, out to the ocean, and I said, sure, I'll go. And drinking age was 21, and we were, of course, I don't know, 16 or whatever, 15, probably 15, and somebody had a fake ID, and they stopped at a store, and they bought a case of beer. And I remember exactly what I had consumed that day. I drank 4 16-ounce cans of Budweiser beer. And instant thought to myself was, where has this stuff been all my life? I came right out of myself. I instantly fit in. I was witty. I was funny. I could do the crazy things they were doing. We went to the beach, and they stopped at a liquor store there, and they bought whiskey and stuff like that. We're sitting underneath the pylons of this, like a casino out over the ocean, like derelicts would do, on the sand, and drinking this stuff and getting drunk. And then there's an amusement park there. We're staggering around drunk and just acting crazy and, you know, not hurting anybody, but, you know, just stupidity like that. And that was fun. And then we went back home. I remember, you know, I got sick that night, threw up and everything, but that didn't faze me the least. And I know at that point, I think I jumped right over social drinking, right to alcoholism, not in the form of consumption of alcohol, but just to, I knew that if I were to have a good time in any given situation, alcohol had to be part of the equation, because that brought me out of myself and made me a fun guy, and I could talk the talk and be witty and all that stuff. I just knew I needed it. And I had a pretty privileged lifestyle. I grew up in an upper-middle-class household, and my father owned a factory, and we had a lot, but I didn't appreciate any of it. I took everything for granted and just didn't. I had all kinds of opportunities for, you know, universities and all, and I just didn't care about any of it once I started drinking. I started to change up, and again, I don't remember what my second drink was or any of that, but I just do remember that I did look forward to, you know, having alcohol to have a good time. And every summer when school got out, we had a summer home up north on this big lake, and we'd go up there. And I started this thing with my friends. I knew a lot of their parents were drinkers, and I got them to start stealing the booze during the course of the day so the parents wouldn't notice it missing. While the parents were drinking, we'd be sneaking in with our quart bottles or whatever and just mixing all, you know, scotch, whiskey, vodka, everything together in these bottles. And we had a barn on our property, and every weekend a bunch of us would sleep out in this barn and would take those bottles of mixed alcohol and buy those whiskey packages of whiskey sour mix or whatever and shake it all up and just pour it over ice and drink this concoction. And it tasted horrible, but it did the trick. It got us drunk, and we'd do crazy things again, running around the neighborhood raising hell, going on the boats late at night when we weren't supposed to be out there and things like that. And there were a lot of signposts for me. I remember one summer had ended, and a friend of mine who lived like 2 hours away from where I lived had called me up, and someone had given him a bottle of creme de menthe, and he said, I don't like this stuff. If you want it, you can have it. And I got in my car, and I drove all the way down there. Probably spent 2 tanks of gas or whatever to get this bottle of, it was probably $2 back then. And I didn't go down there to get it to drink it right away, but I wanted it to stash it and have it in the event that, you know, I wanted it for a situation, party or whatever. I had it. It was just the comfort of having it. And that was a pattern I developed throughout my drinking. When I first started coming to AA and I heard people talking about drinking things other than drinkable alcohol, I'm saying, oh, my God, how could they do that? And I perhaps would have done the same thing, but right from the get-go, I never ran out of booze. I always found a way to get it, because I, too, ended up getting a fake ID. And I ran with an older crowd after that, so alcohol was readily available to me. So whenever I wanted to have a drink, not that I had to have it every day at that point, you know, but it was there. I could obtain it. Things started to happen. No outside problems. I drove drunk a lot back then, and you know, oftentimes the police, more often than not, the police would let you go. They'd take the booze away from you, and they probably kept it. Who knows? But they'd send you home, and they knew your family, and they'd say, you know, we're going to call your father or whatever, and just, or they'd follow you home, and you got away with these things. Today it's a different world we live in, whether it be here or back in the States. I mean, people go to jail for multiple offenses like that, and they stop you for the littlest thing they're looking for it these days. Back then they just sort of, you know, let it go. But I didn't see what was happening to me, but little by little, the changes started up in my head. I started to just not care about things anymore. My priorities started to slip. You know, I had all these problems. I've got a bit of a neurological problem now, so I get twisted in my head sometimes. But I had plans for, you know, college, and I wanted to, you know, be an attorney and, you know, go to law school and all that. And all of a sudden, I didn't care about that anymore. You know, I just wanted to raise hell and have a good time with my friends. Graduated high school, you know, fairly decent marks, not as good as I should have. My guidance counselor had called me in one day, I think it was my senior year, and I had missed a lot of days of school because in the winter I would go skiing, in the summer I'd go to the beach and things like that. And he says, you know, what the F is going on here? He goes, I know you're not sick all these days and everything. He goes, you're skipping school and you're raising hell. I see the crowds you're running with and whatever. And he goes, what about, you know, you're going to get nowhere. He says, your future. He goes, your future's going to hell in a handbasket. I says, I don't have to worry about my future. I says, you know who my family is. I says, it's all going to be mine one day. And he looked at me, and he's kind of laughing. He says, you know, kid, he goes, you're going to have a lot of problems in life with an attitude like that. You know, and he was right. But I just had this, you know, attitude like that, and I just didn't care. Anyway, so I graduated high school. I wanted to go to work for my father's company. He wouldn't let me do that. My parents were big on education because they were both really educated, and they wanted all their children educated, and I just wasn't going to do it. So he says, well, you can't go to work. Why don't you go find a job out in the world somewhere? So I went to work at a nothing thing that I mixed right in with a lot of heavy hitters there. It was a place that made meters for helicopters, and I was working in the machine shop, pulling drill presses and whatever, and punching out dials. And you know, so I'd go out at lunchtime with some of these guys, and they'd be, you know, getting tanked up on beer and whiskey and whatever. Some of them lost fingers and punch presses and things like that. It didn't dawn on me that, you know, that wasn't going to happen to me, and it didn't, you know. And I'd get pretty well lit at lunch and liquid lunches. Nights consisted of going around the city I lived in, going to the pubs and bars and whatever, and just drinking and having a grand old time, not planning on, you know, going nowhere real fast. Things started to change in my life when I was at my parents' summer home one fall, and I met a girl up there. And I know today the only thing that she and I had in common was the drinking, because she was a big drinker, and so was I. I had met her family, and they were real heavy hitters, and the father had a big fancy bar in his basement. We all sat down and we started drinking, and you know, got pretty tanked up and whatever. And they really liked me, and I liked them. And her father prided himself with how much alcohol her brother and myself could hold, because we could really drink booze. And boy, those guys can really hold their booze. He was Polish and from Poland, and they were big on drinking. And you know, he just thought that it was really good. That it was something to be proud of, the way these two guys could really, you know, handle their liquor. And so we started seeing each other, and I got engaged and whatever. And so for about a while before we got married, I would go to her house a couple times a week and have dinner with her family. It was the same routine. We'd sit downstairs and drink, you know, wine with dinner, and go back downstairs and drink after that. And oftentimes, Bob would fall asleep, and I know that, you know, I was like blacked out because I drank so much. And all I needed was about an hour and a half or 2 hours on the couch down there, and your father would wake me up 11:30, 12 o'clock at night. Bob, you got to get up. You have to work tomorrow, whatever. And so I would get up and still having a rapid drive home, you know, and went on like that. So we ended up getting married, and my parents were big enablers for me, and they thought that perhaps if I had some responsibility, my mother kept pushing that, you know, this marriage thing. So I talked about, you know, we're getting engaged, and she helped me out with money to get her a really nice engagement ring and whatever, and things like that. And big promises came down the road that if I got married, they'd help us out with a house right away. And I could have company cars and work for my father. Things would just be wonderful. So it all sounded really good. And here was my ticket. So we ended up setting a date, and we got married. And things happened real fast. My father got us a house on a lake. He owned it for the first year. Then they turned it over to us after a year of marriage. But the first thing that we did when we moved into that house was set up, you know, where the liquor was gone. We grabbed a cabinet in the kitchen, and that's where the half gallons of whiskey, vodka, scotch were. You know, every week I'd go to the liquor store and buy these, and I'd have them in there. And I wouldn't sit there. Even at that point, I wasn't getting drunk every day. Some days I didn't even have a drink. I was probably binge drinking here and there. It was mostly on the weekend, and it would start sometimes, you know, during the weekend. I forced myself to not drink in the morning, even during the times that, you know, my body was craving it, I wanted it, because I knew alcoholics drank in the morning, and I simply didn't want to be an alcoholic. I was exposed to this program early on. I got married in my late teens, and there used to be a restaurant around the corner from where we lived, and they had happy hour every day at 4 o'clock, so I planned my work week so I could land in that place at 4 o'clock and be there right when happy hour started, so I wouldn't miss out on anything. What do you miss out on? Nothing. The same old people doing the same old thing, sitting in the same seats or whatever. And I would compare myself. I'd look at this one, I'd look at that one, and say, wow, he's really bad. If I ever get like that. And of course, I was going down, down, down the progression of this disease, and I couldn't see it happening because, you know, I played the big shot. I was someone who I really wasn't, you know. I'd go out there, I drove, you know, I didn't have I fought to get the cars I wanted. I couldn't just drive the regular company cars that people in the business were getting. I had to have Lincolns and all these things, and that's what I wanted. And I fought tooth and nail, and finally my father would cave in and let me have it. And so I parked right out front at the restaurant, you know, all dressed up and everything. And then it got to the point that I started lying and stuff. I'd go up, my wife would join me up there sometimes. I'd pretend like I owned the company, and she'd say, "Why did you say that? They know somebody your age couldn't own a company like that," and whatever. Just, they're gonna know you're bullshit. And I didn't like when someone impugned my integrity or whatever integrity I had then. You know, we'd get into fights over that and whatever. But so the bartender at this place was in this program. He had like 13 years at the time or something, and he talked to me a little bit about it once, not telling me I was an alcoholic or anything. He talked about himself and told me what he had been through and all. And I really liked this guy. He was a very nice guy. And he referred to this program as his life insurance policy. So one day my wife and I had a big battle over something. She wanted to leave because of my drinking, because there were times that I'd stop for happy hour and I could just leave after a couple, and then there was times I'd close the place, and there was times that she'd come up and join me and whatever. So we were fighting over that. I couldn't grow. They say when you become an alcoholic, you stop growing, and I couldn't grow up. I couldn't be a responsible husband, father. By this time, you know, my son was born and whatever. And I can honestly say I wasn't a very good father. I didn't spend much time with him. I didn't do too much with him. I'd look for excuses to, you know, get in an argument with her so I could run out of the house and say, "I'm leaving. I'm not putting up with your crap." And I'd go drinking with friends or up to that place, that restaurant, and things like that. And this one particular time, I had talked to him because she wanted to leave me because of my drinking or whatever, and I told him about it. He says, "Why don't you come to a meeting with us?" And I said, "Well, I don't know about that." And I said, "I don't think I need that. I don't really think I have a problem with it." And he says, can you stay away from a drink until tomorrow night, or would you need a detox?" I said, "What's a detox?" And he told me, I said, "Of course not. I said, I don't need anything like that. I said, I can stop anytime." So I stopped myself that, you know, that next day. I didn't drink. And, of course, reality hit me in the head like a sledgehammer. I was like, what have I gotten myself into? So I went, and we went on the lake to an area, kind of an affluent area. And he says, "Now, you might know some of the people here." He says, "I don't want you to, you know, it's an anonymous program. Don't divulge identities or things like that." He goes, "And don't compare. Try to identify with what you hear. If something hasn't happened to you yet, you know, don't count on it not happening. Chances are, if you continue to drink," he talked about it, you know, being a progressive disease, "that chances are these things would happen to me." And he gave me all these analogies of, you know, once a pickle, never back to a cucumber. It's like a leaky radiator. You can fix it, but it's going to spring another leak somewhere else. And if you've got this disease, you know, you've got it, and that's the way it goes. And social drinkers don't question their drinking and whatever, and blah, blah, blah. And he was really kind of hardcore about this stuff. And anyways, I went to this meeting, and I heard some real horror stories. People in jails, a guy had killed a woman in a drunken blackout with his automobile, divorces and things like that. And I says, whoa, I left sort of with a comforting feeling that I'm not an alcoholic because none of this stuff had happened to me, you know. And that's the way I left it. And so they gave me a big book, and he and his wife signed it. And it says, you know, hang on to this, and you want to go to another meeting? I said, no, I'm all set. So I decided I was going to start controlling my drinking. I know today if you have to control it, it's out of control. But I did. You know, I stopped for like 4 or 5 days. Let me tell you, those are the most miserable days, probably, I'm not going to say the most miserable days in my life, but they were miserable days. I remember, you know, not the DTs or anything like that, but just the edginess and the way you feel when your body and mind is craving for a drink. And I justified it by saying, see, an alcoholic can't stop. You know, you stop for 4 or 5 days, so you're not an alcoholic. The weekend's coming, so I picked up again. And then it eventually started progressing. It got worse. I was getting drunk when I didn't want to get drunk and drinking more than I had planned on drinking and things like that. And my wife and I were not getting along well. And it was a difficult task to drink because we were big snowmobilers and boaters and everything. And we'd go snowmobiling. I'd be planning a trip, and alcohol was always part of that. That was a big thing, you know, getting drunk while we were snowmobiling. I'd have to plan on how much do I need to prime up on before I leave? How much can we pack with us? When that runs out, I had it all mapped out. We're either going to be near a crossroad with a store, or there's a snowmobile resort in this area, that area. So it was always never without booze. You know, when it ran out, we could replenish. And I was a big controller, the big kingpin out of all this, you know, planning everything, and that's kind of how it went. And I was a real people pleaser. We had this big house on the lake, and we had parties all the time, inviting everybody over. And I would feel lonely with a house full of people, or whether it was outside or inside. We'd be planning the next one because I had to have all these people around me. I wanted everybody to like me, just doing all that I could. And we hung around with people who were drinkers. I mean, the people who didn't drink, you know, I didn't hang around with them. I had nothing in common with them. And I saw a lot of things happen. A few people died, but I thought, you know, that would never happen to me. My neighbor across the street was a real heavy hitter, and he was having a party at his house one night, and he had this vodka drinking contest, and the guy and his wife were up there, and he called me, and everybody was getting really drunk. My wife and I went back across the street home at somewhat of a reasonable hour, probably 2 or 3 in the morning, who knows. But he called me the next morning, and he says, "I can't wake Gino up. Will you come over here?" The guy was dead, and they called, and they did an autopsy on him. He had alcohol poisoning. And that didn't stop any of us from drinking, and myself, I'm going to keep it to me. That didn't tell me anything. That wouldn't happen to me. The old woman that lived across the street from us, when we moved into that neighborhood, people said that you don't see her very often. She's an alcoholic. She lives down in Hyannisport, Massachusetts, on the Cape, and she has this house on the lake, and she goes to the liquor store and the grocery store. That's about it. She doesn't talk to anybody. She's a real mean woman and whatever. But within weeks, we were best friends with this lady, and she was a real hellraiser. And she was a lot of fun to be with. She loved to drink, and we met her relatives. We used to go down to Cape Cod to her house down there with all the relatives, and I would compare their drinking to mine. It's like we went down there once, and we brought a case of beer and a half a gallon of Canadian Club, and they all just sat. They had to sit there and drink it till it was all gone. And I kind of looked at them. We wanted to go around the Cape and see places and whatever, but they just wanted to, you know, guzzle the stuff. And then in the middle of the night, we're all in our own bedrooms, and they're all milling around the house, banging on one another's door. It's like, "Where'd you hide your bottle? I need a drink." And I'm saying to my wife, "Listen to this." I said, "They're hiding their bottles from one another, and they need a drink." I said, they're really bad, you know. Mm-hmm. I wasn't like that. So, anyways, the household was not a happy household. We're not getting along too well, and we're battling. And I had a drinking buddy who hung around with me all the time, and his wife left him because he wasn't providing for the family and all. And my wife felt sorry for him, so he was always going over talking with her or whatever. Well, something started to develop between the two of them, and I sort of saw it happening, and I turned a blind eye to it, and I really wasn't happy. I wanted out of that marriage, and I figured, well, just let the cards fall as they may. And eventually, she left me to be with him. And the irony of this whole thing is I really wanted it to happen, but then once it happened, the anger just took over, and I was like a wild man. And I was pretty tough back then and all, and I was afraid that I might get tanked up some night. They moved. Her father had a camp on the lake where our house was. It was like 6-7 places down the road from us. And she moved in there, and he moved in with her. And I was afraid that I might get tanked up some night and go down there and do them both in or something, because I was so angry with, you know, how could he do it? How could she do it? And it was out of my control. I was a control freak. I had to have control of everything. You know, I never lived in today. I worried about the future. I worried about the past. I was so wrapped up in material things. I was afraid if I got divorced, if I lost this, I don't want to lose this. I don't want to lose that. I don't want her having my kid. I don't want him bringing up my kid. So I'll fight for custody. And I got my family on my side because, you know, they stuck up for me because she was cheating on me. So we'll back you up. And I said, we'll get you the best lawyer. I don't care what it costs and that type of thing. So even though they did all that for me, it was hell to go through. But the day that she left, I believe the grace of God came into my life, because I always believed in God, but I didn't dare not to, I guess it was. And I would, you know, kind of strike up bargains, get me out of this one, get me out of that one. But that day, I was crying on a staircase in the house and asking God to let me die. I had nothing more to live for, because I was afraid I was going to lose my trappings and things like that. And I changed that plea to help me. And something happened where I just picked up the phone, and I called up that guy who had taken me to meetings, and I told him what was going on. And he asked if I would go to a meeting with himself and his wife that night, and I said, sure. So I went, and I listened, and I kept going. And then by this time, it was kind of, like I said, it was a kind of a different world back then. They weren't suggestions. They told you what to do. We're going to pick you up. We're going to this meeting. We're going to that meeting. And there weren't that many young people, but there were a couple, and they sort of hooked me up with them. They'd call me up. I remember one Sunday night I wanted to stay home, and this woman and her boyfriend called me up and said, we're going to pick you up. We're going to the meeting and blah, blah, blah. And I said, I don't know. No, we're coming to pick you up. Just be ready. We'll go. So they did, and I went with them, and I kind of didn't say no to people and started to do it. And I started to do what was asked of me. But I wanted to know when the desire was going to leave, the desire to drink. You know, what was life going to be like, you know, 2 weeks from now, 2 months from now, 2 years from now. And I worried about my divorce, and I was just horrified about that whole thing. And I saw people were happy at these meetings, and if I lost everything, I figured I wouldn't be happy. I'd be miserable. I mean, I have nothing to live for. Even though my family was backing me, it's like just the shame and everything, you know, because of, you know, the ego I had. It's like that they got this, that they took my house from me or whatever, and I was just a basket case overall. But the people in this program helped me. They told me that I'll lose what I need to lose, and I'll gain what I need to gain. And if I work this program, I'll gain myself. And I realized I never had myself. I didn't know who Bob was or what I wanted in life or whatever. And so I started to work this program, and I bought it hook, line, and sinker. I went to a lot of meetings. I asked for help. You know, I started helping people and helping myself, and I mixed in with a group of younger people. We'd travel around different states. We'd go to anniversaries, and I learned how to dance sober and all kinds. We started to have fun, and we'd go up into the White Mountains in New Hampshire, and we'd rent cabins up there and raise hell and have a good, you know, good, clean fun sober. We had a lot of fun doing things without the booze in us and realized that there was another side to this. You know, you could have a good time without alcohol. And I have some of those friends are in my life today. Some of them are dead because they went back out again. One person, this guy who was very close to me at the time, and we were good. We had a good friendship for the first 10 years of our sobriety, then he went out and started drinking again, and I hadn't seen him for 12 years. And I went to his funeral last February where he had died from, you know, drugs and alcohol. It had brought about a cardiac arrest from all these things in his system, and he was dead. And a couple other people died just as, you know, that had gotten sober with because they went back out there. So this disease is a killer, and I take it serious. You know, and, I settled for less for a lot during life. You know, and I want the most out of life, and I got it out of this program. I'd like to say I traded a lot of things for alcohol. As far as my education, I did continue that. You know, I put myself back into school. Luckily, I was working for my family, and I was able to get the time to do that. So yeah, I went to college and ended up starting my own business. I got into real estate and then got a partner. And then I wanted to go. I put myself into law school. I got custody of my son. I got him when he was 4 years old, and it wasn't easy. Here I was, could barely take care of myself, and here I was, had to get lunches and things ready for this little kid and work and whatever. And, you know, then when he got a little older, I was going to school nights and weekends and whatever and running a business and taking care of a kid. It was just crazy, but I did it, you know, and if it wasn't for this program, I wouldn't have done it. So I had a great life and a great career for many years, and things were going really well. And there was this woman, Rita, who lived in the town I lived in, and she was 25 years sober, and she was a born-again Christian, and I was bothered by the God signs and everything. It's like, oh, here we go. It's going to be this religious stuff, and I realized it wasn't anything to do with religion. And this woman really helped me. She never pushed her, she never tried to proselytize me to her religion or pushed, you know, whatever denomination she was in or whatever. She would help me out with straight, basic AA stuff, and they kept talking about God's will and turning it over, working the third step, and because I was aware of it, and it says, you know, let it go, turn it over, ask your higher power for help. If you believe in God, you know, call him God or whatever. It doesn't have to be God if you don't believe in God. Just know that, you know, your higher power is not you, and get a sponsor. And I kept the sponsor right along. And so, anyways, I called this woman up, and the court for my divorce. It took about a year and a half, 2 years. It was really long and drawn out and terrible. And I'd call this woman, read her up. I said, you know, I'm going to go crazy. I just got another notice. We have to go back to Superior Court. I says, a month and a half from now. She says, I'm going to stop you right there. She says, think about what you just said. She says, a month and a half from now, going crazy today, is that going to change the outcome? She says, you're projecting. You have these scenes going on. You have these courtroom scenes. I says, yeah, I do. She says, why don't you just let it go? Chances are it isn't going to happen that way. It might even get canceled. It could be worse, but I doubt it. She says, but just let it go. Try to live in today. And I realized I never lived in today. I still dwelled in yesterday and worried about tomorrow. And you hear the sayings like, you can get hit by a bus today or tomorrow may never come. And I just talked to a friend of mine who's not in this program and not an alcoholic, but he's got an insurance thing going on. And we went out to breakfast today. And he was really worried about it, about this situation that's coming up with his lawsuit. And I said, you know, I said, why don't you just let go of it? I said, worrying about it today, and, you know, I've been up a couple nights. He said, I said, you know, why don't you just keep it in the now? I said, keep yourself awake. Is that going to change the outcome? You're doing the best that you can do. You've got a great attorney. I said, let it go and deal with it. And that's the philosophy I adopted for my life. I used it in business decisions and everything else. If there was a problem going on that we did the best that we could, whether it be for myself or business or whatever, I would just let it go and go home for the weekend or for the night or for whatever and let it go and deal with it. Sometimes these things resolve themselves more often than not. And so anyways, I eventually learned how to keep it in the now. And that's one of the best things I got, was to keep it in today, because I was a worrier, like I mentioned earlier, since I was a little kid, and that progressed throughout my drinking. And even when I stopped drinking in the beginning, the booze wasn't there to buffer things. It was like, you know, I wasn't Mr. Intrepid anymore. The fears, doubts, and insecurities started to set right back in early sobriety, until this program started to work on me, when I started to work this program and get into the steps. And I can honestly, I can't say enough about the steps, because if it weren't for the steps, I wouldn't be here today, because they changed my life. I didn't have the big outside troubles, but I had the problems here, how I perceived life. You know, my happiness was situation dependent. If I had plans on something and it didn't go my way, I was miserable. Well, now, it's not like that anymore. You know, I can go with the flow. And my daughter-in-law's grandmother was a psychiatrist, and I think I mention this a lot. She has this big lodge on a big lake up in the state of Maine, and she has this painting on the wall that someone made for her, and it's a picture of a sailboat, and it says, I can't change the direction of the wind, but I can adjust my sail. And that's what I learned to do. Things are going to come down the turnpike at me that might not be favorable, whatever, but I can adapt to that. I can adjust my sails, and I can, you know, in other words, things aren't going to go my way all the time, and I'm just going to have to go with the blows and then deal with it. And I learned how to deal with it through this program. And if it wasn't for this program, I wouldn't have learned that, you know, because I didn't pick up these things. When I became an alcoholic, you know, when I was a young kid and started drinking, all the things I should have learned, you know, as a teenager, those are the formative years where you learn your basic coping skills and things. I took a left turn somewhere, and I didn't learn any of that stuff. I learned it my way, and the way the people with whom I would associate with dealing with things, you know, not the right way either. And I learned that from this program. And I learned to love myself and other people, and to do things for people, to help people. And, you know, I try to get the most I can out of this program. When I was early on in sobriety, I busted my butt to try to feel good. I wanted to have a smile on my face like a lot of you people had. I wanted to be able to, if things didn't go my way, that I could deal with it and everything would be okay. I wanted to feel like that. And I knew there was some semblance of truth to that, because everybody was saying it. They couldn't all be lying about this stuff, so why don't you try it? But I was so analytical, I would try to analyze it. My sponsor would say, let it go. Don't try to analyze it, because it's a simple program for complicated people, used to say. Just don't complicate it. Just keep it in the now. Do what you're supposed to, and it's going to work. And he used to say this saying, and I found it kind of corny. He goes, there's a certain magic in the room there. Because I'd walk away from a meeting, and I didn't get that meeting sucked, or I didn't get anything out of that meeting. He goes, yeah, you did. He goes, there's a certain magic in that room. You might have thought you didn't get anything out of it. Something sunk in, whether it be subliminally or whatever. But, you know, you absorb something from it. You get something out of every meeting you go to, whether you like the speaker or not, or what they had to say. Just keep going, and going and going and going and keep going. I said, how long do I have to keep going? Keep going till you like to go to meetings. And that happened. At first, it was kind of the interest was there because I liked to hear the stories. And then it was like, another meeting. And then I kept going until I really got the fever to really want to go to meetings. I still have that. And I hope I never lose that, because and most of the things I say, I heard from other people. This woman once said many years ago, I try to keep myself green. Like all the things I did in early sobriety, to take away the pain and the fears and everything. I still do them today, because that's when I started to feel the best, when I really busted my tail to do these things. And I do them today because, again, I don't want to settle for less. I want the most out of life. And how I get that is by really working this program like I did in the very beginning. Now, I mean, there were times in my life, I've been sober almost 24 years, that I've gone on vacations in other countries somewhere. I didn't speak the language. And I'm saying, oh, I don't speak Spanish. I'm not going to go to that meeting. You know, and why should I go? And, you know, I never even think of it. It's probably English or French meetings I can understand or whatever. And then I'd go 2 weeks without it. And I didn't instantly have the desire to drink, but some of the old personality traits would start to creep back in. I'd be short-tempered and things like that and start worrying about stupid things. And inevitably, that leads to a drink. And I've been to enough meetings, and I see what happens. They say meeting makers make it, and people who don't go to meetings, that's often the reason they went back out again. And I'd rather be dead than go back out again, because I know what's waiting for me out there. I mean, it wasn't all that bad on the outside. You know, the disease didn't manifest itself in outward ways for me. But it's out there. It's ticking away in my body, and those are waiting for me. And I know I have another drunk left in me, but I don't want to take a gamble on whether I have another recovery. I hear there's a lot of people who come in and out like a revolving door. God bless them that they can do it. I can't afford to take that chance because I might be one of those that might get killed the next time I go out and get drunk or not make it back, and even worse, live out there in that misery. I started coming here, you know, when I first got sober, so I've never had a drink in the city. I've been coming here 20-some-odd years, and I've lived here for quite a few years now, and I just moved from downtown to Nuns Island. It was getting kind of rough where I was living, and people were getting robbed and stuff, and I just wanted a safer place to live, so I had a lot of friends out there, so I moved. And things are going good, so I spend a lot of my time here and a lot in the States, and probably a few of you have heard, in June of 2004, I almost died. I was diagnosed with a brain tumor that was inoperable, and they told me that I had 2 weeks to live, and so anyways, I ended up, that hospital I had gone to really couldn't do anything. They told me I just to go home. I had 2 weeks to live. I took a helicopter to one of the best hospitals in the United States, and a team of neurologists met with me, and before I blacked out that day, they told me that they could, there was hope for me, that it was inoperable. It wasn't malignant like the first hospital had told me, that it would be a rough road ahead. The next 6 months would be tough, but if I got through that, I could live a normal life expectancy. So I said, okay, and I went out. And had I not gotten there that night, I would have died. I didn't have 2 weeks to live. In fact, my doctor told me that the other day, just before I came back here on the 25th, I had an appointment with him. We got talking about it, and he talked about that. He goes, you were almost dead that day. He goes, you're lucky you made it. And he told me, he goes, that's not, it's still there, but it's shrunk down to nothing. I have some problems from him. He goes, yeah, you're going to die. He goes, it's not going to be from that. He goes, it's going to be from a heart attack or whatever. He goes, you're going to live a normal life expectancy. He goes, that's not going to affect you anymore. And I have some neurological damage from it right now, which, nothing that I can't, live with. I still take a lot of medication, and my memory is not what it used to be, and I have these tremors on the left side of my body, so I have to take strong medication for that. So I took early retirement from my job, and at first it drove me crazy because for like a year I couldn't do anything. I was home, and I was a real mover and a shaker. I was never home. I never watched TV. I never just sat around. I was always doing something, and I was going nuts. And so my son and daughter-in-law moved. I have a big house back in the States, and they moved in with me because I really needed help because my equilibrium was off, and I couldn't really drive or do anything. I needed a lot of help, and she had to get all my drugs for me and put them in order for me to take them during the course of the day. And I was taking like 50 pills a day at that time to eradicate the tumor and things like that. But I made it, and all because of, and this program really was helped me immensely with that. I mean, they had me talking with psychiatrists and psychologists and asking me, if I'm angry, and I'm saying, why would I be angry? She says, well, why did this happen to you? I says, well, why not me? I said, I have a friend of mine, and I told him I was in this program. I said, she's 23 years old. She had a double mastectomy, and the cancer's throughout her body. I said, there's no hope for her. She's going to die. I said, but I'm going to live. I said, no, I'm not angry. Are you scared? I said, surprisingly, no. I said, normally I think I would be. I said, but I'm really not scared. And I really wasn't. I went through the whole thing, and, and the doctor just said that was astounding. It was an astounding result in recovery, and he was just amazed that I got through it the way I got through it because no one else had ever responded in such a positive fashion as I had. And I have a lot to do today, even though I'm not working. I'll put in some time, part-time for the office here and there, but I really can't sit down with clients and do what I used to do because I told my son, I lost a little horsepower up here, and just sitting with somebody, and all of a sudden asking a question, you lose your train of thought. That doesn't work too well. I have a hard time remembering names sometimes. My short-term memory is really screwed up, and a lot of my long-term memory is lost. I forget things, but I haven't forgotten the things in this, this program, because I guess I've rehearsed it so many times, and I know that, I'm going to continue to go to meetings, and first and foremost, I'm an alcoholic, and nothing else matters after that. If I don't have my sobriety, I don't have anything. I have a great relationship with my son. Like I said, I got custody of him when he was 4 years old, and he's 28 years old today, and he's doing really well. He's got a great career, and he did all the things that I didn't do it from the beginning. I put him in a good school and everything and made sure he got educated, and he bucked me at first, but now he appreciates it, and, he's an incredible father to his son. I have a four-year-old grandson, and that's such a blessing because the first 4 years of my son's life, I don't have too much recollection. Not that I was drunk on a daily basis, but I was in that ozone from drinking and just, kind of where you're at. And I don't remember when he first started walking and talking. I just remember he started calling me Bob, and to this day we thought it was kind of cute to let him do that. And to this day, he still calls me Bob. He never called me Dad. And I kind of liked it. It kept me feeling younger or whatever. I don't know. But I let him do it. But they moved in with me, and my grandson was there. And it's like I saw this little bugger growing up since he was just a little guy, and he was in my life, and he's the best thing that ever happened to me. He loves coming up here. I live in a high rise. I'm way up there, you know, where I am here. And he was up here this summer, and he's like went nuts when he came in. He couldn't believe how high he was. And I faced Montreal. I could see all the buildings, and I'm right on the river. And he says, "I'm going to sit right here." He sat for an hour, and he's pointing at buildings and bridges, and asking me. He's very intelligent. He asked me what this is, what that is, and he just loved it. He was diving, using the diving board at the pool, and he just loves coming up here and loves spending time with me. He's my little buddy when I'm home. He runs around with me, and when I go to my appointments at the hospital and the doctors and all that, he comes along. They all know him, and he's really well behaved, and he's just such a joy. And I didn't do any of that stuff with my son because I was too into myself, my drinking and partying and the early sobriety. I was still a wreck, you know, in the very beginning, going through the divorce and all, and trying to get myself on my feet and get a direction in life. But that's what AA gave me, that direction. You know, I know who I am. I was able to, replace the things I lost that I traded for booze and lead a useful, productive life and, be a good human being. And today I try to treat people the way I want to be treated. And I had a hard time at first, with the higher power thing, asking for help and all. And they told me to get on my knees. I wouldn't do it in the beginning. And then I did. And once I started doing that, things just started to work better for me. And so I do that today. I get up in the morning, I ask my higher power, I ask God, to help me through this day to not have a drink or drug or not hurt anybody. And at night I thank God for a successful day of sobriety. And it's as simple as that. Don't drink, go to meetings and ask for help. And I talk to people if I have a problem going on, and I get some really good objectivity on my thinking. I'm my own worst enemy if I, take the advice that this head gives me sometimes. It's not always bad, but sometimes when you embark on certain decisions, you need to get the insight from a sponsor or other people in this program. And I'm talking too long here, and I'm very grateful to have had this opportunity to share with you people. And if anybody is new, believe me, I didn't think I was that bad in the beginning. Maybe some people, are feeling the same thing. If you're questioning your drinking, chances, social drinkers don't question their drinking. I didn't drink too many Coca-Colas to come here, even though I was talking to somebody recently. In fact, it was here. I'd gone out to dinner with somebody, and they had asked me, so while you're here, how long have you been sober? I said, almost 24 years. He says, so you could have a drink? I said, no. I said, yeah, I could. I said, but I have options today. I said, and I choose not to. I said, I don't want to have a drink today. He said, yeah, but nobody would know. I said, yeah, somebody would know. Because you're so far away from... I said, no, I go to meetings here. That's not the point. I said, I would know. I became honest with myself that I don't lie anymore. To thy own self be true. And I said, I couldn't live with myself. I said, if I picked up, even if I was able to just have one, which probably wouldn't happen, I'm not willing to take that risk. I said, I would be inundated with such guilt that I couldn't deal with it. And I said, and I don't want to compromise that. And I said, it's not worth it to me. A lot of these new things came out on the market that weren't around when I was drinking. And sometimes you see that and you wonder. I quickly get that thought out of my head, because I might as well look at a skull and crossbones on that ball because it's poison to me. And that's about it. We're out of time here. Thanks again. And if anybody's new, hang around because it will give you a life second to none. I used to hear that a lot, and I didn't want to hear it. You know what I'm saying? What do they mean by that? But stick around. You'll find out what it means because it is a life second to none. I've never been so happy in all my life. And even with the major changes and catastrophes that happened in my life, losing my parents and almost dying and all, you pick yourself up and you move on with life in a different direction, and it's all good. Thank you very much.